I want to begin today by pointing out that under the Old Testament, or under the old system, the Jews had an old saying. And their saying was that whoever does not teach his son a trade is as if he brought him up to be a robber. In other words, everybody had to learn a trade. Everybody had to learn to do something with their hands. And so even the rabbis had a day job. Even the rabbis took up a job where they could support themselves. And Saul, who was at one time considered a rabbi, is an example of this. Saul, though he was educated as a scholar in the Hebrew law under the celebrated Gamaliel, learned a trade under his father's tutorage, or at least under his father's direction. Paul learned how to be a tent maker. He learned how to make tents with his own hands. And so we see that when Paul goes to Corinth in Acts chapter 18 in his second missionary journey, that the text says in verses 2 and following that he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. He came to them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they were working, for by trade they were tent makers. And so Paul was a tent maker. And Paul, at the very beginning of his stay in Corinth, made tents during the daylight hours. In fact, from 1 Thessalonians, we also learn that when the need arose, that Paul would work at night as well, just like anybody who works a trade. They'll work whenever they have to. And Paul talks about this, so here he was writing to the Thessalonians about his experience there. He says, "For you recall, brethren," in verse 9 of chapter 2, "you recall, brethren, our labor and hardship, how working hard day and night," pardon me, let me read that again, "our labor and hardship, how working night and day, so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim the gospel of God." And so Paul would work night and day sometime, supporting himself with his trade. And when he goes to Corinth for the first time, the first few weeks there, I guess, or first few days he is there, he is working hard in the day, and then on the Sabbath, he takes the day off, not to rest, but to proclaim the gospel. On the Sabbath day, he would go and he would proclaim the Jews in Acts chapter 18 and verse 4, trying to persuade them to believe that Jesus is the Christ. And so during the weekday hours, which would be from Sunday to Friday, Paul would proclaim or make tents. Then on the Sabbath day, he would proclaim the gospel in the synagogues. But this arrangement did not last the whole time he was in Corinth. Paul did this for a time. But the text tells us, beginning in verse 5 of Acts 18, that when Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the Word, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. In other words, once Silas and Timothy came to him, Paul no longer devoted himself completely to the Word only on the Sabbath day. But he began to devote himself completely to the Word throughout the week. He was wholly absorbed in preaching. Paul restricted himself, the indication of the language implies, he restricted himself to preaching as opposed to continuing his involvement in the tent business. But what changed? What made it so that Paul could now devote his whole time to proclaiming the gospel? How was he now able to devote all of his energy to preaching the gospel of Christ, proclaiming the word, when previously this was not possible, when previously he had to earn a living to support himself? Well, first of all, it wasn't because the church in Corinth was now supporting him. The church in Corinth had not taken up Paul's support so that he could begin to proclaim the gospel full time. Though Paul had a right to do this, as we see in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, and though the Corinthians may have been willing to do this for Paul, and we indicate this or find this because they were willing to help others who had come to them preaching the gospel, Paul did not take advantage of this. Paul did not use his right to do this. And Paul refused to use this right, he says, in 1 Corinthians 9, and we'll turn to that verse later on. But a reason that he refused to use this right was found, I believe, in verse 12 of chapter 9, and we're going to spend more time in this chapter later on, but let me read verse 12, where Paul says, "If to others, or if others could partake of this right over you of receiving financial support, do we not the more? Nevertheless, we do not use this right, But we bear all things that we may cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. Paul must have seen something in the Corinthians, some worldliness in the Corinthians, which caused him not to take support from them, at least in that congregation. Because he said, I did this so it would not cause any stumbling block, so we would not cause any hindrance to the gospel of Christ. You see, just like in every age, there are charlatans who go around from place to place who make their living speaking, who are great orators, and who do a great job talking and talking, and they do it just to get money. And they're just bad people. And Corinth was full of such men who had come through with this philosophy or that philosophy, and these speakers may not even believe what they're saying. They would just make speeches because people like to hear these speeches. And kind of like talk show hosts sometimes, you know, who like to talk just to be talking. They may not even believe what they're saying, but they say it anyway. Well, Paul was not going to be associated with them in any way, shape, or form. He became to preach in Corinth, and he wasn't going to be receiving money from them lest it cause a stumbling block to the gospel. That was Paul's reason. And he may have had other reasons, and I'm sure he did, as 1 Corinthians 9 brings out. So the point I want to say is that Paul, though he was now devoting himself fully to preaching the Word of God and no longer involved in tent-making, it wasn't because the Corinthians had taken up his support. That wasn't the reason at all. So what enabled Paul to devote his full energies to preaching the gospel? What enabled Paul to devote his full time to preaching the Word instead of dividing his time between tent-making? And the best answer, I believe, is found in the text itself. It says, when Silas and Timothy joined Paul, Paul then began to devote himself to the full-time preaching. That's what the text says in verse 5. When Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul then began to devote himself fully to preaching the Word. I would like to suggest to you that Silas and Timothy, when they came from Macedonia, came not empty-handed, but apparently they brought with them some money given to them for Paul's work in Corinth. And I think we're in safe ground to say this because of what Paul says in his second letter to the Corinthians. Turn there, if you will, to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, beginning in verse 8. 2 Corinthians 11, beginning in verse 8, where the Apostle Paul says, I robbed other churches by taking wages from them to serve you. Paul talks about this event, that he was with them, and other churches were supplying him with his wages so he could serve the Corinthians. And when I was present with you, verse 9, and was in need, I was not a burden to anyone, for when the brethren came from Macedonia, they fully supplied my need, and in everything I kept myself from being a burden to you and will continue to do so. Paul did not want to be a burden to these brethren. Again, I believe because he thought that it may cause some hindrance later on with the gospel. You only preach because of the money. You only speak because you're getting money for it. And Paul did not want anybody to say that of him. So when these brethren came from Macedonia, they came with money from other churches so that he could devote his full time in that area of proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ. Paul said, I robbed other churches. The word robbed is a hyperbole. It is said as kind of an exaggeration for the sake of emphasis, suggesting that whereas the Corinthians should have been the ones supporting him, sustaining him in his work, that others have to take up the slack. Now again, the apostle refused Corinthian support as a matter of expediency. He saw from the very beginning, like I said, some worldliness in them, some of the brethren that. And so he took away the stick that they might use to beat him with later by refusing to accept any support from them. And this wasn't the only time that Paul received financial support from churches. Paul received it in Corinth, but Paul also received it while he was in jail, while he was bound in jail. The kids and I were talking about that in our class, about Paul being bound for the gospel. And when he was bound for the gospel and was unable to travel freely, brethren were still supporting him, which I think is an interesting concept. That sometimes we think that if a man is not free, fully free, as we are, that maybe he shouldn't deserve support. But Paul was supported even when he was bound in prison. And Paul talks about this support in Philippians chapter 4. Turn there, if you will. Well, he's writing the Philippians, thanking them for some money that they had sent to him while he was in prison. And listen to what he says beginning in verse 15. It says here, "You yourselves also know, Philippians, that at the very first preaching of the gospel after I left Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving but you alone. For even in Thessalonica you sent a gift more than once for my needs. Not that I seek the gift itself, but I seek for the profit which increases to your account." He goes on and says, "But I have received everything in full, and have in abundance. I am amply supplied, having received from Epaphroditus what you have sent, a fragrant aroma, an acceptable sacrifice, well-pleasing to God." Paul received money from the Philippians on more than one occasion. While he was in Thessalonica, he received money from them as well. And I've said all this simply to establish an important principle for us as we think about biblical things. And that is that the one who proclaims the gospel has the right to live by the gospel. The one who preaches the gospel has the right to be supported by the gospel. Paul said this very succinctly in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 14 when he says, "So also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel." That is a biblical precept. That is a scriptural idea that we need to keep before us. And where did the Lord ever say such a thing, like Paul suggested that he said here in 1 Corinthians chapter 9? Well, I believe it was probably in Luke chapter 10. In Luke chapter 10 and verse 7, where the Lord, giving some instructions to the 70, says to them, "Stay in that house, eating and drinking what they give you, for the laborer is worthy of his wages." The laborer is worthy of his wages. And I think we need to understand there is a biblical principle there for the support of men who labor in the gospel. And just as an aside, when you read the qualifications of elders, elders too are qualified to receive support from the congregation. Paul talks about that as being able to get a double honor. And that's just an aside, but I do believe that's an important thing to keep in mind when we consider the use of the Lord's money. Now, over the centuries, now let me just stop for a minute. When I was growing up, I have vivid memories of going to Mass with my daddy and my mom. And I went to St. Ambrose Church there in Houston, and the priest at the time was Father DePremio. And he was a little bitty guy, and he was the head pastor of that church. And I have vivid memories of the Catholic Church at that time, at least that area, building a new church, a new building to meet in. And I remember Father DePremio getting up there, and every week after week, he'd get up there and pound the pulpit saying, "We need to give more money. We need more money." And I remember my daddy leaving there complaining. That guy was always asking for more money. And he was, to be honest. It seemed like every sermon was, "We need to give more so we can build this building." And the whole sermons were based upon that. And I guess there may have been other things he preached on, but that was the thing that he focused on the most. And I know talking about money is a big problem with a lot of people. You know, we don't like to talk about money. I don't like to talk about money. It's usually a very private thing. But money is one of those things the Bible does talk about, and supporting men who preach the gospel is one of the things the Bible talks about. And so from time to time, these kind of things must be presented so we can have an idea of what does the Bible actually say about these things. Now, over the centuries, there have been countless godly men who have tirelessly labored with their hands to support themselves so they could proclaim the gospel. You go back and read restoration history in this country, and you go back and read any kind of history where the gospel is being planted in the new land, and look at the sacrifices that men made to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. They did so at their own expense. They did so at their own sacrifice. They were devoting themselves, like Paul, to working hard throughout the day, and then at night studying or having Bible studies and all this. And much good work over the years had been done by men such as that. And those men need to be applauded, and there are still some men alive today who have done that in the past. They're almost all gone, but there are still men around like that today who are so dedicated and who proclaim the gospel at their own expense. And we owe them a vast debt of gratitude. But having said that, we must understand that this is not the divine ideal. It is not the divine ideal that the laborer labors at his own expense. That is not what God would have the churches to do. The ideal is that God's people should support financially those who utilize their time and their energies in preaching the Holy Scriptures, in preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. Let's look at some scriptures. Consider Luke chapter 10 and verse 7. We read this or referred to this a few moments ago, but let us look at it again. In Luke chapter 10 and verse 7, Jesus here is sending out some men, the 70, to proclaim the gospel. And again, he says, stay in that house. He's talking about men going to various towns. And once you get to these towns, find a place to stay. Stay in that house, he says, eating and drinking what they give to you, for the laborer is worthy of his wages. Do not keep moving from house to house. In other words, they weren't to be looking for some better accommodations. They were to stay in one place, accept what the brethren were giving to them to support them, and then stay there until they left. That's what the Lord said. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, we referred to that a while ago, but let's turn there. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, we see here these things here. It says here that preachers have this right to accept support. And I want to just kind of skim down here. That was really been up so long, I wanted to kind of bullet out, but it's been up there a while. So you get to see it all at once, and that's fine. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, we see that Paul says in verse 4, that preachers have a right, he says. He says a right to be supported. Look there, verse 4, it says, do we not have a right to eat and drink? And of course they do. Then in verse 5, he says, do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? And the idea is not just that they have a right to be married, but don't we have a right to be married and the churches supply us with support to live off of? That's the implication. And Paul said, yes, we do. I have a right to be married. I have a right to have a wife. I have a right to have a family and be supported while proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ. Again, as an aside, I've often said that the reason why the Catholic Church will never allow married clergy, is because they don't want to support women and their children as well, the husbands and their wives and their children. They think it's already too expensive to support just individual men, single men. And what would happen if they had families, and families like the Catholic Church wants them to have? Huge families. I mean, it would be a great burden. But Paul says, I have a right to do that. God gave us the right to do that. And then in verse 6, he goes on and he says that, don't I have a right to refrain from working? Here I am preaching the gospel, and yes, I do make tents when I need to, but don't I have a right not to? Don't I have a right to be fully supported so I don't have to have this outside job to kind of make ends meet? And of course, it's rhetorical. Yes, you have the right, he says, to be supported like this. And then again in verse 7, he says here in verse 7, who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Who tends a flock and does not use the milk of the flock? And the whole idea is, nobody works at their own expense. I mean, you try it sometime. Well, you go to work I'm here just to work and you don't have to pay me. I'm just doing it on my own. Oh, they would love you. Your employer would love you. I mean, what a great boon that would be for him. But nobody expects to be working at his own expense. That's what Paul is saying here. But there's more. As we keep going on, the text says that they're Old Testament examples. Show us that the right of a man to be supported. Or he says in verse 10, pardon me, verse 8, the second part, he says, does not the law also say these things? He says, for it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. God is not concerned about oxen, is he? And of course not. I mean, yes, God is concerned about ox, but this is the principle. If God's so concerned about a dumb animal, what about a dumb preacher? And the answer, he's concerned about them too. He's concerned about these men too. No, the ox is able to go around the threshing floor, unmuzzled, so he can eat of the grain, eat of the food. And that's a principle. If God shows such concern for those beasts, what about those who labor for the gospel? And he says in verse 10, or is he speaking altogether for our sake? Yes, for our sakes, because it is written, the plowman ought to plow in hope, and the thresher to thresh in hope of sharing the crops. We go on. Those who sow spiritual realm should be able to reap physical benefits. Says Paul in verse 11, if we sow spiritual things to you, is it too much that we reap material things from you? If others share this right over you, do we not the more? And there's the indication that the Corinthians were prepared to help people, you know, because others were doing it. And Paul says, if others can do this, can't we? Don't we have such a right? Nevertheless, he said, we do not use this right, but we endure all things so that we would cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. And Paul goes on, and he says in verse 14 that the support of gospel preachers is something that the Lord himself has ordained. So as the Lord directed, those who proclaim the gospel ought to get their living from the gospel. It is scriptural for the churches to support men who preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. It is scriptural for a congregation to do this. Preachers have this right to be giving a wage for their work, and this right came from the Lord itself. Now it is certainly not wrong for a preacher not to exercise his right to receive support. Every preacher that I am associated with has preached often without being supported for it at their own expense. I have done this. And let me just say, I would be very saddened to learn of any of my friends who preach, and anybody that I know who preaches, who would not preach if they didn't receive some money for it. I would be terribly disappointed in those people if they were not prepared under certain circumstances to refrain, to not exercise their right to support. And so let me just say that preachers have the right not to be supported and all that. But the truth is, however, is that when preachers use that right not to be supported, it is very easy for churches to become spoiled. It is very easy for them to become spoiled and even abusive to those who preach. Let me explain what I mean. I understand from my reading that Alexander Campbell was a very rich man. And Alexander Campbell did not receive support from the churches that he preached in. He was wealthy. He did not need the churches to give him money while he went here and there and everywhere to preach. And he did go many places to preach the gospel at his own expense because he was a man of means. But I'm not certain that what he did was really a very much of a help to his fellow preachers who were not wealthy. Because you see, the churches that had Alexander Campbell come to preach for them didn't have to pay him. And so when these other guys came along, they would use him as the example, and they would say, well, he didn't get any money. And then if they felt they must give him money, they would only give him a very minimum amount, a very small amount, maybe just enough to cover his expenses and not enough to cover other things that he may have needed. I'm not sure it did much good for Campbell to do what he did, but that's a long time ago. But let me just say, churches are prone to take advantage like this because they have in the past, and I'm sure they would still do so today. Now, some people think that whenever the preacher preaches, that whatever he gets is just charity. They say, this is just charity. But I want to differ with this. Paul doesn't call it charity. And Paul doesn't call what he received for preaching a love offering. Paul called it a wage. Paul called it a wage. He said, I robbed other churches, taking wages of them to do you service. Secondly, some people think that a preacher should not be paid any more than what is necessary for him to live on. Randy likes preacher stories. There was once a preacher who, when asked to move at a certain place, the brethren said to him, well, what would you need to live, or what would you like to get? And the preacher gave them a figure, and after the brethren regained their composure from this original figure, they asked him, well, what do you have to have? What do you have to have to live here? And the preacher proposed that they go ahead and pay him the figure that he gave, and then at the end of each month, every family in the congregation would work up the call sheet and then give everything else they had left over to the church. The brethren didn't like that. But that's what they were asking the preacher to do. They were saying, what do you need to live on? We don't want to give you any more. And the preacher was wise. And he said, well, let's all do the same thing. We'll just live what we need to live on and then give the rest to the church and leave nothing for yourself. They weren't prepared for that, but that is exactly what they were asking the preacher to do. Brethren, Paul calls what he received from the brethren his wage. I robbed other churches, taking wages of them. And why is Kerry preaching on this? I can just see that's going in your mind. And why am I preaching on this when Patty's not here? You know, that's a little. But let me just say, when I first announced I was going to move to Duluth, a brother came to me and said, I want you to preach some lessons that I haven't heard you preach on before. And I want to hear you preach a lesson that I haven't really heard much teaching about. And this is one of the things that he wanted me to talk about. He wanted me to talk about the support of preachers. And in fairness, I do believe that the elders here have talked about this. I think Mo did. I think it was him. I wasn't here for that, but I think he did. And so we have touched on it before, at least our elders have. And so this is what I am preaching on, and this is why I'm preaching on it. He asked me, tell me or preach a lesson on what you think a preacher ought to receive to live or to work at a certain place. And I have to say that I don't know the answer to that. I just don't know the answer to that. For I've always found it difficult for myself to determine what I need to receive. I've always found that hard and difficult, and therefore how can I determine this for other people? I certainly can't, since I don't even know for myself what I need to be getting. But I do know this, that those who preach the gospel have a right to receive a wage that will cover their day-to-day expenses, their mortgage, their utilities, their groceries, their medical, their taxes, their car payment, their insurance, like life insurance or health insurance. They have a right to receive these kind of things, which I would consider to be almost essential. Somebody may say, well, the insurance is not. Well, we'll put that in the other category in a minute. But what about some other things? I mean, these are the essentials, or at least some of the things that we may consider the essentials. Does the preacher have a right, or does the congregation, or should the congregation support the preacher so he can save? Save for his children's education. Save for the yearly vacation. Save for retirement. Maybe he wants to purchase a nice car. Maybe he wants to purchase a Cadillac. Or at least a used one. Maybe that's what he wants. But should a congregation supply the preacher with money that he can save for these kinds of things? My opinion, of course, is yes. But it's up to the other congregation to figure these things out. And somebody says, well, you know, he's our worker. He works with us. And that's true. But everybody who has a job, or at least most people who have a job where these other things are sometimes included. Now, self-employed people don't always have these kind of things. And I realize we have self-employed people in the congregation who don't have all these benefits, but people who work for other people, it's not uncommon for them to have these kinds of things. And so should the congregation consider this whenever they're thinking about hiring a preacher or getting a preacher to work with them? What can they give to him over and above what he needs on a daily basis to live his life? Should he receive any more than what is necessary for these day-to-day expenses? Should he receive money on this second column that would support these kind of things? And would it be appropriate? Would it be appropriate for a congregation to give the preacher a bonus occasionally? Lots of companies do that for their employees, and lots of people appreciate it. Is that appropriate? Again, the congregation must decide these things. The congregation must make a determination about these things. These are legitimate questions that somebody should ask whenever they're thinking about hiring a preacher or supporting a man to work with them on a full-time basis. How much will they pay the preacher? What will this include? These are things that we need to consider. Sadly, some still think that poverty or near poverty is a prerequisite to spirituality, at least for preachers. The feeling is keep them poor and keep them humble. And I believe this view is heavily influenced by the truth that wealth brings with it many temptations. And that is certainly a true statement. A book was written a few years ago by a fellow called Randy Alcorn, who claims that 9 out of 10 Christians survive adversity with their faith intact, while only 1 of 10 survive prosperity unscathed. Isn't that interesting? You may survive adversity a lot better than you can survive prosperity. And I think, from my experience, that's probably pretty good. That's probably pretty good. That sometimes it's easier to be mistreated for the gospel and undergo trials for the gospel than it is to be wealthy. I know that I have some friends who became very wealthy very quickly, and it didn't do them any good at all. And I'm sure we can all think of people such as that. Scripturally speaking, the possession of wealth is not to be regarded as sinful. But on the contrary, it is looked upon in the Scriptures as a sign of a blessing from God. In Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 9, and also in 6 and verse 2, wealth is considered the gift of God, something that God gives. But while it is not sinful for a man to have wealth, and I'm talking about any man to have wealth, there are some warnings that the Bible gives with regard to wealth, that wealth can be perilous to one's salvation. Look at what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 19. He speaks more plainly about it than anybody else. In Matthew 19, beginning of verse 23, Jesus says, "Truly I say to you, it is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Again I say to you, it is easier for the camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven." The rich young ruler that Jesus speaks about is perhaps the greatest illustration of this. In fact, when you read Luke chapter 18 and verse 22, he actually says these words in Matthew 19 right after his confrontation with this rich young ruler. He tells this rich young ruler to go sell everything that you have and come follow me. The man had asked him, "What must I do to have eternal life?" And he says, "I've done all the law says." And Jesus says, "You lack the one thing." And the text goes on to say that the young man went away grieved because he was the possessor of many things. And so we see here that wealth can have its problems. That wealth can stand in our way between heaven and it can lead the way to hell. The young man became distressed because he was extremely rich, and there is no indication that he ever changed his mind. It is because of the danger of losing one's soul through the possession of wealth that so many exhortations are found in the Scriptures against wealth or about wealth, are aimed especially at Christians who have an abundance of this world's goods. Turn, if you will, to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, beginning in verse 9, where the Apostle Paul, giving instruction to the young man about the things he is to preach and the things he is to long for, he says in verse 9 these words. He says, "But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and the snare, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, and some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." And then he tells the young preacher to flee these things. This seemed to be a warning to Timothy, the preacher, that Timothy was not to be concerned about all this wealth that maybe others had had. And maybe he was had a tendency, who knows, to be a little bit envious of these people who had all this money. And Timothy was told, flee this love of money. Flee these things, O man of God, and pursue righteousness and godliness and faith and love and perseverance and gentleness. In 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 17, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited, or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. He says, "But on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous, to be ready to share, storing up for themselves a treasure for a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed." Here we see this admonition to the rich, telling them, don't be conceited. Put your hope in God. It is God whom we trust. I know we have that on our coins, but it means nothing. We don't trust in God. It was meant to remind us of a God, to remind us that our prosperity comes from Him. But nobody thinks of that anymore. They may as well just take it off, because it means nothing. Because we don't trust in God. We trust in the Almighty Dollar. In James chapter 5, we see this instruction toward the rich. On this occasion here, the prophet is giving a warning to those who are not Christians about their end because of their abuse to their laborers, to their hirelings. In James chapter 5, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Come now." Let me just get there real quick. He says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days you have stored up your treasure. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you, and the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and put to death the righteous man, excuse me, who does not resist you." Here we see this warning to those who are not Christians about their end because of their abuse of their wealth. Furthermore, Jesus told parables about riches and stuff like that. He told a parable, for example, about the rich fool in Luke chapter 12 and warned people about that. But let's kind of go on and kind of summarize some things. The scriptures do talk about a warning about wealth. It talks about wealth has a tendency of making people conceited or high-minded. And you can read the verses yourself if you're taking notes. Wealth tends to make people trust in themselves. They're confident in themselves. Why? Because they're wealthy. I have money and I have this confidence. Wealth also at times can cause people to take advantage of the poor. You know, you love your money so much, you want to get everything you can out of this guy, and therefore you'll withhold the wage or you'll cheat him out of a few bucks just so you can have a little more in your pocket. Wealth also causes us to be selfish. And again, Luke chapter 12 and Luke chapter 16 talk about this. Now, I don't want to imply that it's impossible to be wealthy and go to heaven, because that's not what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches us that there were very, very wealthy men who were very righteous. In the Old Testament, we have Job. We have Abraham. In the New Testament, we have Nicodemus. We have Joseph of Arimathea. We have, I think, the apostles John and James seem to have come from a family of means because their father had hired servants. That's a sign of a wealthy person. Wealth in itself is not necessarily wrong. The rich, however, have many spiritual pitfalls that the poor don't have. But let me say the poor have pitfalls too. But they can covet and they can envy. So poverty and wealth both have their pitfalls. But it seems that the wealth has more pitfalls even than the poor. The Christian who earns his wealth through righteous industry, and I want to emphasize righteous industry because there's many people who are wealthy through dishonesty and through ungodly means. But the individual who has become wealthy through righteous industry is warned not to say within his heart, "My power and my strength of my hand has made me this wealth." But they need to remember that the Lord, your God, it is He who has given you the power to make wealth. And those who are wealthy need to remember who got them there. It was God who got them there. But very often, wealth causes us to forget the God who gave us these good things. Now you may think I've digressed, that I've stopped talking about preachers and their salary. But I haven't digressed at all. What I'm pointing out is this, is that there is a danger not only for the preacher to have a lot of money, but there is a danger for all of us to have a lot of money. That's a dangerous thing for all of us. There are pitfalls for everybody here to have a lot of money. Now, somebody says, if I had all this money, all my problems would be solved. And only to receive a new set of problems that you never had before. Your immediate problems may be solved, but you will still have many other problems because of your wealth. No, wealth is not sinful in itself, neither is poverty righteous in itself, but it really matters where the heart is. And I have no right to tell you how much money you can make in your affairs, how much money it is righteous for you to make. I know there are some in our society who would like to put a limit on what a person can make. I don't have that right, and you don't have that right toward me. We just don't have such a right. But we do have a right to warn one another and admonish one another to be careful. Be careful with regards to money. I don't know how much preachers should receive for their labors over and above what they need to day-to-day expenses. That's for each person to decide. That's for the congregation to help the preacher to decide. Though there are undoubtedly some people who preach who have made merchandise of the brethren, and there are some who have become extremely wealthy, and especially among the denominations. But there are brethren who have become extremely wealthy because they have preachers and they've accumulated an unwarranted amount of wealth. This congregation needs to be sensitive to the fact, and I'm talking about the Tingsboro Church, need to be sensitive to the fact that most preachers do not receive much over what they require for their day-to-day expenses. Most do not receive much over what they require for day-to-day expenses. Now, I've said these things not because I want a raise. That's not why I said this. I said this because somebody asked me to preach on this. But I also say this in behalf of the fellow who follows me, if and when I leave. Because he needs to have some security that he's going to a place that will know how to take care of him and will take care of him in a way that is in accordance with the Word of God and sensitive to his needs. And that's an important thing. That's an important thing. Because like I say, it's easy for a congregation to get spoiled and to become somewhat abusive to men who preach. I have not experienced that a lot, but I know many godly men who have. And we just need to be aware of this. I wrestled about whether I should preach this morning, but then when I got a call from last night from Brother Kingery, and his dad was going to preach tonight, I said, I need to preach it before I leave for this short break. We're going to see how my mother-in-law is doing and just seeing what's going on there, which will help us to determine more about what we need to be doing here, if anything. But I do hope you've taken this to heart. I do think it's important. When you give out of your prosperity, yes, you are giving partially to support the preacher. You need to support him adequately so he can be comfortable with his family, so he can take care of the needs he may have over and above what is necessary for life. I think you do, and I think that's important, not just for me, but for all others. So when you give out of your prosperity. Give in the way that God has truly blessed you. And I know we're living in hard times, and I know that the economy is not as hot as it was a few years ago. And I know we've lost lots of people in the last few months. But I know, too, that some of us could probably do a little bit better at giving than what we are doing. There's a lot more to be done than besides supporting the preacher. We may be able to start the radio program up again in a few months. That may be something that we need to get back going again. There's benevolence that we need to do from time to time. There are other men who, from time to time, need our help and need our encouragement. So let us think about these kind of things. Let us think about them soberly and realize that the Bible does have something to say about this. And I hope that you will take it for what it's worth. I really haven't talked today about becoming a child of God. That wasn't the intent of this sermon. But many of you who are here, who are visiting, have heard sermons about how to become a child of God before. You must be born again into the kingdom of God. You must be born again to enter into his family. But you are not born again simply by doing good things. If you were to write a check out and start writing weekly checks out for hundreds of dollars, it would not be enough to buy your way into heaven. You could do nothing to earn your way into heaven. But what you need to do is to humble yourself before God in the way he has required. If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, if you believe with all your heart, then you can be baptized. And what's so significant about being baptized? Well, baptism is the way that God has planned, the way, the means, the entrance into the kingdom. You must be born of water and spirit, says Jesus. We become a child of God by faith when we are baptized into Christ. If you believe the gospel and you know this truth, then why delay? Why put it off? Arise, be baptized, and wash away your sins, calling on his name. The water is ready, and so are we. We'd like to help you this morning as we stand and sing the Bible.